You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of February 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show...
And let me be clear. The attack on the Jewish minority in Denmark is an attack on all of Denmark.
The Danish Prime Minister insists that the weekend's attacks will not change the values of the country. Quentin Peel and Tim Marshall will join me in the studio to discuss the consequences of the violence in Copenhagen, as well as the other main stories of the day. Then we'll hear what propaganda was like on both sides of the English Channel in the time of Napoleon.
They show him as a Corsican bandit with huge moustaches, and he's making the Pope kiss his bare backside.
We'll also speak to our woman in Lisbon and review the latest exhibitions in London, Stockholm and Washington. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. But before all of that, here's Suzanne Chislett.
Monocle 24 News. Egypt has carried out a second wave of airstrikes against Islamic State group targets in neighbouring Libya. They come after a video was released showing the beheadings of 21 Egyptian Christians by the extremists. Libya's Tripoli-based parliament has strongly condemned the strikes in the eastern city of Derna, saying they're an assault on the country's sovereignty. A Greek government official has said a draft text presented to Eurozone finance ministers in Brussels would not be accepted. The document reportedly sets out an extension of the current bailout package, something Athens has said would be unreasonable. Talks are now understood to be on hold. Ahead of the discussions, the German finance minister, Wolfgang Schäuble, told reporters Greece has lived beyond its means for a long time, and there's no appetite in the EU for giving it more money without guarantees. His Greek counterpart, Yanis Varoufakis, said the country refuses to be treated as a debt colony. The Irish finance minister, Michael Noonan, was sceptical there would be a breakthrough today.
Nothing happened over the weekend which could be described as a breakthrough. And I think the ball is back in the Greek court again now with a request to them to explain to the rest of us what exactly are they looking for.
The Ukrainian government has rejected an offer from pro-Russian rebels to open a safe corridor so troops can leave the surrounded town of Debaltseve in the east. The separatists say under the terms of the Minsk agreement, the key railway town should remain under their control. The OSCE, which is trying to monitor the ceasefire, says its staff have been prevented from entering the town. As many as 7,000 Ukrainian troops are thought to be trapped there. The Danish Prime Minister, Helle Thorning-Schmidt, has said the weekend attacks at a free speech rally and outside a synagogue in Copenhagen represent attacks against all Danes. Two men have appeared in court accused of helping the suspected shooter. He's been named by Danish media as Omar El Hussein and was shot dead in a confrontation with police. The chief rabbi of Copenhagen, Jair Melchior, said Jews in Denmark could receive support from Muslim leaders around the world and would not be cowed by terrorists.
We will not let terror dictate our life. We will continue living as Jews here in Denmark and everywhere else in the world. Their goal is that we will go around and be afraid. Everyone who are in charge of the security will do what they need to do to secure our life. We will focus on living our life, go back to normal life, and showing the terror that they won't dictate our way of living.
Nigeria's military says it's recaptured the northeastern towns of Mungono and Marta from Islamist Boko Haram insurgents. The extremists had seized Mungono on the shores of Lake Chad last month, in a triple offensive that also targeted a town called Konduga and the airport of the main northeastern city of Maiduguri. A conference on the business potential of cannabis is underway in California. Hundreds of delegates are attending to explore how to make money as more states discuss legalizing the drug. Already, five have made it lawful for people to buy and use cannabis without a prescription. Ty Mayfield is among those considering an investment.
I'm interested in getting into the cannabis business. It's an emerging market that's going to be legalized relatively soon, and I think there's a lot of opportunity, not just for production, but for the pick and shovel kinds of businesses, the support businesses.
And schools have reopened in Liberia 7 months after they were closed as part of efforts to contain the spread of Ebola. Last week, the country's president said the disease was now under control. In recent weeks, only a handful of new cases have been reported. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. See on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, and the time here in London is 18.06. It's 13.06 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Quentin Peel, Senior Fellow at Chatham House, and Tim Marshall, Diplomatic Editor for Sky News. Welcome both to the programme.
Thank you.
Danish Prime Minister Helle Thorning-Schmidt has sworn today that Denmark will emerge stronger and more united after the weekend's attacks. Two people were killed in the attacks on a cafe and a synagogue in Copenhagen. Parisians have been seen expressing their solidarity with the citizens of Denmark after their own experience of the attacks on the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo and a Jewish food store last month. The reaction from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been the same as the last time. He has been calling for Europe's Jews to migrate back to Israel. Well, his comments have sparked irritation in Europe and at home, and it has been speculated that his response is purely politically motivated. Tim, let's come to you first. You know, are these attacks in the same nature as those on Charlie Hebdo? When we see the kind of profile of the accused, it seems he was a bit of, you know, not just a lone wolf, but maybe a bit of a strange character. He may have been somebody who could have been violent anyway. He doesn't seem to be so committed to the cause in some senses.
That's true, but I do think there are parallels. And this all goes back to 2 years ago when one of the Islamist groups said, from now on, we recommend go out and do lone wolf attacks. And there's been quite a few since then, and there's going to be quite a few in the future. And the parallel is that he first chose a freedom of speech meeting. That's the Charlie Hebdo correlation. And then he went on to attack a Jewish target. And again, that's the grocery shop connection. So I do think there is a connection. I do think there is a pattern. And I'm sad to say, I think there's going to be more. I mean, the headline of what Netanyahu said is actually just gets in the way of understanding the real story. I do not believe that Europe's Jews are yet in the position of packing the suitcase. I don't think they feel that way. And I don't think it's necessarily helpful to sort of put that in their minds. But it is incumbent upon the various governments of Europe to take this threat very, very seriously, because there are going to be more attacks like this and worse against both minority populations and the majority populations.
Quentin, the difficulty for all the authorities, I guess, is that in the past, even in the recent past, when we saw terrorist attacks, they were terrorist attacks and they were organised well in advance, and the security services could listen in and apprehend these people, hopefully, in advance. Here we seem to have characters who are doing things almost off their own back, last minute, or it feels almost kind of spontaneous in some senses. Very difficult, do you think, for the authorities to react in a way?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I think that it's much more difficult to catch them. Having said which, all the people involved in Charlie Hebdo and this guy in Denmark were all on the books already. They knew about them. They had actually been following them, or indeed, they'd been inside in prison already. I think what's in common with them is, between the two cases, is also the fact that they were native. These were young men who'd been born in the country and grown up in the country. And therefore, there's a sad side to it too, because I think they were very sort of desocialized. They were outsiders, outcasts from the society, who'd found perhaps a degree of Islamism to inspire them because they were so much the outcasts. But very difficult for the security services to track these people down.
You know, it's not really the moment for these societies to look at their own kind of issues, but already in some of the papers they're saying, oh, well, you know, the that, you know, Denmark does have a problem kind of pulling in new migrants. There is like white Danish society and many migrants still find it hard to become part of the community. This neighbourhood, Norbro, where the gentleman was shot, is known as a neighbourhood, as a migrant neighbourhood. It's not seen as really integrated into Copenhagen. Do you think either of you, do you feel that there is a moment for, after we've been through the next few weeks, for the Danes to also think about how society is run? Or is this character a loose person? Sorry, Quentin.
Yeah, well, I think that one, we've seen in Denmark in recent years quite an upsurge in anti-immigrant feeling. This was, goes back before the cartoons of Mohammed and so on. The growth of the Danish People's Party and so on, anti-immigration and anti-Muslim. And Denmark also has a certain, it's a wonderfully civilised society, but there is this core of sort of, we do it best, we know best in Denmark. It's quite in common with the United Kingdom. Denmark may be, not be an island, but there's that rather insular mentality. And I think, therefore, an extra effort has to be made somehow at the integration process, because there's the feeling of being alienated in the immigrant community is not helped by having a pretty fierce anti-immigrant debate.
I agree with all of that, but there is a caveat, and it's a reasonably controversial one. I do think that the European societies, many section, parts of it are racist, are anti-immigrant. I do think that immigrants do have a problem, both verbally being abused, physically being abused, you know, across the board. I understand that and think that needs to be combated. However, the terrorist attacks in France and in Denmark and elsewhere that have been against Jews and against freedom of speech have not come from the communities of the Hindu immigrants or the Sikh immigrants. And so it is a two-way street. Why have not the Hindu immigrants in the United Kingdom formed small cells? Why have they not been encouraged to kill people? Now, that is not to say that the Islam is trying to do this, but Islam has a problem in that it has been radicalized in these small areas, and that because of the racism in the European societies, when you look for an answer of what to do, and you've got someone abroad trying to fill your head with the sort of propaganda of the Islamists, as opposed to Islam, and there is a huge difference, then they reach out to each other, and then you have that problem. So that is actually a two-way street that the communities themselves have to look at. What are we also doing about this? Because, as I said, the Hindu communities and others are not plagued by this internal problem, but they are plagued by the same external problems of racism.
Quentin, Tim has already given his viewpoint on it, perhaps, but what's your view of the call for Jews to move back to Israel? Do you think it's just electioneering and posturing on the behalf of Netanyahu?
I do think it shows that Netanyahu's just got a tin ear on something like this. He just doesn't really get it. I mean, it's ridiculous that your answer to terrorism is to turn tail and run away. No, that's absolutely not the right answer. And I think that the Jewish communities in European countries know that full well. And also, I must say that all my experience of Israel is it's not exactly a country which one would feel deeply safe and secure in. It's a very neurotic country too. So if I were a member of the Jewish community in Britain, France, Denmark, I don't think I'd listen to Netanyahu for a moment.
We have a little story in the magazine, in the new issue that's just come out, which is about also that many young Jewish people are leaving Israel and going and settling back in Europe. They're going back to Germany, even to Berlin, because they find it easier to they find it easier to run a tech industry from there. Well, we're going to move on now. The ceasefire in eastern Ukraine is proving to be fragile. Fighting continues. The Ukrainian military command says that pro-Russian rebels have attacked over 100 times since the start of the supposed ceasefire, mostly in the contested Debaltseve area. At least 5 Ukrainian soldiers have been killed in the fighting during the past 24 hours. Quentin, it is a fragile piece, but it does seem to be that the fighting is quite concentrated around Debaltseve. Do we feel that there's a kind of a tussle going on there and it may hold the wider piece?
Well, I'm quite surprised that it actually held as much as it did, because on the ground, everybody one hears from that region just is sort of saying, we're not ready to stop. You know, we've lost too many people. We feel the need for revenge. We want to gain ground and so on. So I'm quite startled, really, that actually it's worked as much as it has. Now, I still don't think that actually it's with us for a long time. But if it's bought enough time, perhaps, to try and steady the situation, I don't know. I mean, I think that Angela Merkel did an amazing job to actually really knock people's heads together and get them together. But actually, I think fundamentally there is a real problem. And the real problem is that Mr. Putin has not a very coherent game plan, but he's a real operator. He seizes every opportunity to expand. And going for Debaltseve, this place which is, you know, where all the fighting is, well, that's actually closing up a loophole. It's a very important railway interchange, so they need to get it to make their territory coherent. And there'll be another and another. I think they'll go for Mariupol, and I think eventually they may go right across
the country. Just going to go to that geography, because I think that let's go to the Mariupol geography first, because it leads us back to Debaltseve, which you've learnt to say better than I have, Andrew. If they were to take Mariupol, then they take the coastline towards Crimea, which is in the Sea of Azov, which goes into the Black Sea. And you can have contiguous territory all the way along that coastline into Russia. If you take Mariupol and you have access to Crimea, it's a jumping off point down next year or the year after for Odessa. Odessa is a jumping off point to get to Transnistria in Moldova. And that cuts Ukraine off from the Black Sea. You can have this scenario within 5 years where all the way from Moldova, right round in a curve to Russia, that belongs now to rebels, in other words, to Russia. And that is the long-term game plan. But you need this town as well to do that, to join up the existing bit. The railroad is where all the coal comes through for Ukrainians, a heavy industry. But if you take that railway town, you can put all that coal back the other way and you connect it into Russia. And that's why it's so bad there. The 6,000 Ukrainian troops trapped, they are more or less surrounded. If they do go for that, they're going to have to kill lots of them. And that means the entire ceasefire will crumble very quickly. If they don't do that, then this can be a frozen conflict until such time as Yeltsin decides to unfreeze it.
But Tim, don't you think, I mean, one of the ironies here is Russia doesn't need any of that coal. Russia doesn't need any of the economics of this area.
It wants people to back off. Yeah. This is a massive two fingers to
Europe. But actually, it needs it like a hole in the head. They'll end up pouring money into
it. And Crimea,
So actually, you know, every time Putin takes a chance, he's actually creating quite a risk for himself.
But it's about nationalism, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. It's not a coherent policy.
Do either of you think that, you know, when Putin signed up to this deal, gave his backing to this deal with Angela Merkel, that he kind of wanted it to hold? Or do you feel that he kind of went along with it because it looked good and it kind of gained him some time? Do either of you believe he would like to see the position hold at the moment?
I really think it's possible he may have thought, okay, this far, I don't want to gamble too much. And he might want to freeze it. But as I said, I cannot believe that he means a lasting peace the way that the other side wanted it, Merkel wanted it. I think if he does mean it, and he might, it is only that he means it temporarily.
He's made an incredible mistake by alienating Angela Merkel, I think, by getting her on the other side. I mean, Germany was always the country that understood Russia and wanted to bind them in. Maybe he's trying to get a little bit of ground back and try and get back into her good books. She's a formidable negotiator. You wouldn't want to take her on in the middle of the night.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Quentin Peel and Tim Marshall. When we return, we'll discuss what can be done about the surge in the number of migrants trying to cross the Mediterranean. And we'll ask if renaming the most famous British people and places is going to help attract more Chinese visitors. Stay tuned.
Whether you want to know the latest in the world of luxury retail...
It's a wonderful experiment. I love that idea and I can see people really going for it.
Or analysis of the main movers in the aviation sector.
It's a great brand, it's a great service in many ways.
Tune in every weekday at noon London time for The Briefing. From our studios at Midori House in London, we bring you up to date with all the latest news, as well as insight and analysis from our unrivaled team of industry experts.
I do think that companies get to a certain size when they get too big for comfort.
We also take a look at what's making headlines across the Atlantic.
all the papers are pretty much covering it in different ways. The New York Times, we'll look at that first. They have a few stories about it. They have the straight news story, and then they have a more human interest story.
A pacey roundup of the day's key stories and fresh reports from our correspondents and bureau all around the world. Every weekday at noon London time, tune in to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Quentin Peel from Chatham House and Tim Knott Marshall from Sky News. Well, the Italian Coast Guard rescued more than 2,000 migrants in a massive operation off Libya's coast during the weekend. Last week, at least 300 migrants drowned trying to cross the Mediterranean. According to Italy's transport ministry, the rescue teams were threatened by armed men who approached them in a speedboat. Apparently, this is also the first time it's happened. Well, Quentin, how much do we actually know what's going on here, do you think? Why there is, we know there's fighting in Libya. Do we feel it's just people are trying to escape from there?
Yes, I think the main factor is that actually it's total collapse in Libya. I mean, before we ever went in, before the British and the French ever went in, they knew, although I don't think it got through to them, that actually Libya was containing a huge potential migrant flow from further south in Africa, from Sudan, from countries like that, that were in chaos. And Gaddafi, nasty guy that he was just holding them back. And now we've seen actually the end consequence of that, which is the country has collapsed and a flood is coming through because there's nothing to restrain them coming. And Europe doesn't have a coherent strategy to handle the whole thing. We're facing a real catastrophe, a humanitarian catastrophe, and we don't have a strategy. And as for the British government, it's turning away and saying, nothing to do with us, we'll send one observer.
Tim.
Yeah, it's pretty depressing. I mean, I'm a great believer in joined-up journalism and I'm a great believer in joined-up diplomacy, and I don't see the joined-up diplomacy at the moment. And you can join this story up to what is happening in Iraq. Yes, in Iraq and Syria. And let's not forget the Middle East has a Mediterranean coastline, quite a long one, including in Syria, including in Egypt, including in Libya. The south-to-north movement was happening anyway before this whole so-called Arab Spring. And it will continue to happen, even if things calm down. But it has been massively accelerated and magnified by what has happened over the past few years. And you can't blame people. They're desperate to get out. But we don't have a policy to try to manage the situation. We don't particularly have a policy to stop what could happen. And that is Boko Haram in Nigeria connecting up through the Sahel and the Sahara, all the way up to Libya and Algeria and other places, and making things even worse. Now, they're very, very different beasts, Boko Haram in Nigeria. But they do, but my enemy on all that, they do want to connect to each other so they can have the flow of arms and weapons and destabilize those whole regions. And if and when they do, what we've seen now is only going to get worse. And yeah, it needs to be addressed properly at a Mediterranean and European level.
But that notion of, you know, Sky was there, on, you know, famously, you know, covering the events as Gaddafi fell.
Well, I looked at a piece I wrote just today, actually, and I said, because we were with then the rebels, which are now the different militias, and I remember writing at the time, the moment this is over and Gaddafi's gone, these rebels will splinter. There is huge amount of Islamism, especially in certain towns, and they're going to form Islamist groups. And you would have hoped that the joined up diplomacy knew that as well.
But Quentin, when we look at that country now, it's, you know, there's a kind of official government that the West recognises but doesn't really run the country. Yeah, it's splintered. We saw, you know, just yesterday and today, Egypt trying to attack ISIS bases within the country. There is no sense of any kind of improvement going to fall on that country any time soon, is there?
No, it's awful. I mean, the government, we recognise, as far as I can see, controls about a few square miles.
Well, they're in Tobruk, aren't they? Yeah. They're as close to the Egyptian border as they can get in case they have to run across that border. That is the government of the country. Yeah. It is a failed state.
And then, I mean, it's a big country which has actually always had a small population, extraordinary amount of oil, and a lot of desert. But it was like almost a sort of great gap in the wall that people could stream through necessarily and attracting people. One of the noticeable things, of course, about these poor migrants is the incredible variety of countries they come from all over. Yeah. And it's as if they're being funneled through. And then over the Mediterranean they go in these desperate conditions with these people traffickers, half the time, you know, sinking their boats if they can't get through.
We said Somalia on the Med, and it's slowly coming true.
Yeah. Well, we're going to move on now. We're going to look at the story about Chinese tourism and how to attract a Chinese tourist to your country, it seems. As part of a push to get more in the UK, the national tourism agency Visit Britain has given some of Britain's most famous people and landmarks new names in Mandarin Chinese. Big Ben is going to be known from now on as Da Ben Zong. London Eye will be Lun Dun Yang, sorry about that. And the Beatles, they're going to be called Pitu Shi, as in gentlemen with long hair. Visit Britain believes that creating Mandarin names will promote more engagement between the Chinese and British people, and this will make more Britain more attractive to the Chinese. Quentin.
I'm sure you've got the tonality.
No, I think my Mandarin needs a little bit of polishing up. It's just as cold. Normally, I'm more fluent, actually. Do you think this is likely to appeal to Chinese visitors?
Well, it apparently comes out of an enormous sort of internet-based exercise where they were trying to get people to make their own suggestions. So it's not as if the suggestions are completely wacky. At the same time, I mean, I feel if I were going to China, I would want to know what the Chinese call their things rather than invent silly names for them.
Well, I began to laugh at the story. I've ended laughing at the story. But in the middle, I thought, well, hang on, let's try and take this seriously. You know, what do they call the Great Wall in China? They call it the Great Wall. So imagine if we tried to rebrand it over here. Well, it is Long Wall with many fortifications that keeps out barbarians. And you end up in Beijing saying, excuse me, where is the Long Wall? And they say, what? Now, put it back this way. So there they are in London, walking along the Thames, and they say, excuse me, do you know where the Jiaxing Ta is? Excuse me? Do you know where the tower that allows us to pluck stars from the sky is? You say, sorry? And then they would say, do you know where the Shard is? So, oh, yeah, it's just down there. You know, when I go to Paris, I don't want to ask somebody where great tower made by engineer in 90. I just want to say, where's the Eiffel Tower? And it's much cooler if you know what it's called. It's a nonsense.
Well, even the translation of the Beatles, isn't very helpful, really, like no. Gentlemen with long hair, is it? Well, they didn't even have long hair when they started.
No, they didn't.
There's one good one, the Highland Games, isn't it? That's wonderful.
What's it remind me of the Highland
Games? Strongman Skirt Party. I mean, that sums it up. The only thing I might add is Strongman Skirt Party without underpants.
Yeah, then I think you're heading back into the Big Ben territory as well.
And on that bombshell.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us. Great to have your views on how you attract Chinese tourists to visit London. I just wanted to say a special thanks to both of my guests. That's Quentin Peel and Tim Marshall.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tóquio.
Essa é a Mônaco 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Mônaco 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
Esto es Mônaco 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai a Mônaco, vai a City Chase.
From London,
London, caralho.
This is Mônaco
24.
Well, plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We're going to check in on our correspondent in Lisbon. We're going to review new art exhibitions all around the world. And we'll hear what propaganda was like in Napoleon's era on both sides of the English Channel. But before we get started on that, here's Suzanne Chislett with the world news headlines.
Thank you, Andrew. Egypt has carried out a second wave of airstrikes against Islamic State group targets in neighbouring Libya. They come after a video was released showing the beheadings of 21 Egyptian Christians by the extremists. A Greek government official has said a draft text presented to Eurozone finance ministers in Brussels will not be accepted. The document reportedly sets out an extension of the current bailout package, something Athens has said would be unreasonable. Talks in Brussels are now understood to be on hold. The government of Ukraine has rejected an offer from pro-Russian rebels to open a safe corridor so troops can leave the surrounded town of Debaltseve in the country's east. The separatists say under the terms of the Minsk agreement, the key railway town should remain under their control. And the Prime Minister of Denmark has said the weekend attacks at a free speech rally and outside a synagogue in Copenhagen represent attacks against all Danes. Two men have appeared in court today accused of helping the suspected shooter, who's been named by local media as Omar El Hussein. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Suzanne. You're listening to Midori House, and the time here in London is 18:30. It's 21:30 in Moscow and 12:30 in Mexico City. And we continue now with a check-in with our correspondent in Lisbon, Simon Tariq, who joins me on the line now. Welcome to the show. And we're going to start with a story about what Portugal's making of events in Greece, because I understand that people are a bit torn about whether to kind of admire or frown upon Syriza's actions.
That's correct, Andrew. And basically, it's interesting because during the crisis of the last few years, both Greece and Portugal have been often bracketed together. But now it seems like they're worlds apart, economically, politically, and even socially. It's very different, the situation here for Greece. But as you said, opinion is torn because many people are supporting the idea of exiting the Eurozone, of writing off the debt, because there is still a lot of debt to be paid off here, despite economic growth and other positive signs. So yes, many ordinary people are showing sympathy. The Prime Minister, however, is talking more like a tough northern European creditor at the moment. He's defending austerity and saying Syriza's bid in Greece is essentially a fairy tale.
Why is he defending the austerity? Because how well is Portugal doing at the moment? You know, we see some good numbers around the kind of industrial sector, certainly some reshoring of manufacturing coming back to Portugal from countries like China as it becomes more competitive. Is Portugal doing quite well at the moment?
It's definitely attracting a lot of foreign investment, which is boosting the economy beyond just tourism, which is also growing, as you know. But I think, depending on what statistics you look at, I mean, the socialist leader and also the current mayor of Lisbon, António Costa, which according to many polls will be likely to become Portugal's next prime minister, he is still describing the bailout and the terms as an abject failure. He's talking about poverty. He's saying that basically, even though Portugal is in a better situation, austerity has not brought growth. It's just brought greater hardship to people. And there's still a massive debt load of 130% of GDP. So, it's doing better in the matters that you say, like industry and foreign investment, but there's still a lot to be done.
Now, is it one of the consequences of that, I know that some of the banks are being sold off, and there's potentially a bidder now for the Bank of Portugal?
That's correct.
Not for the Bank of Portugal, rather, for Nova Banco, but the Bank of Portugal is obviously kind of overseeing the sale.
Yes, the sale of Nova Banco, which is the good bank formed out of the toxic assets of Banco Espírito Santo. There are 15 institutions currently approved, 15 institutions who have expressed interest, even though there's been a confidentiality agreement until the end of March, so we can't know any more details or names until then. It is said that there's several Chinese investments and a big Spanish bank. But at the moment, I mean, in terms of the inquiry into Ricardo Salgado at BES, I still feel like there's going to be a lot of bad news coming out because of relationships with BES Angola. And there's been a lot of scandals about letters he'd sent to the commission. Apparently he had meetings during the time that's been questioned in terms of his fraud allegations with the president of Portugal, the former foreign minister, Paulo Portas. So, yeah, a lot is going to happen in the next couple of months.
And currently, Ricardo Salgado, who was the CEO, he's still in jail pending trial.
Yeah, I think maybe now he's under house arrest, but definitely it's pending trial. And I think it's really hard to get any sort of predictions. I mean, I've been talking to one of the economic correspondents at Publico, and she was telling me that really anything can happen. In her personal opinion, she thinks that he's not going to be, I think he's going to be let off lightly and he'll probably leave jail after the trial. But I mean, it's really hard to say what's going to happen.
And finally, we should talk about drug decriminalisation. Now, this has been a policy in Portugal for some time. You know, they didn't chase after people for small amounts of possession, and they've relaxed the drug laws. What's happening now?
Well, the law is still the same, but last week the Minister of Justice, she argued for a change in the policy, which would eventually mean legalising the sale of soft drugs. Now, currently, buying soft drugs is not criminalised. It's treated, drug issues are treated as a health problem and not a moral problem. The government has immediately came out with a statement saying that the minister, Paula Teixeira de Cruz, even though she said that there's not going to be a change at the moment, but she's arguing, yes, that basically that there were more funds would be diverted to better uses of the police, dealing with organized crime, money laundering, violent gangs, and that basically they'll free up a lot of resources if they did change the drugs policy. Essentially, it's been working. I mean, abuse has been cut in half in the nearly 15 years since they decriminalized drugs in 2000. And, I mean, the government's thrilled with the results. There are many delegations from abroad as well, from the States, from other European countries, seeing how the policy is working. So, yeah, it took drug abuse out of politics and it made it into a health problem.
Well, thanks for bringing us up to speed. Those stories all out of Lisbon. That's Saima Tariq, who's Monocle's correspondent in the city. And just so you know, we're doing a conference in Lisbon in April. It's going to be running from the 17th to the 19th of April, which is going to be looking at events around the world, but more about quality of life. But we'll be certainly looking at some of the key things happening in Portugal too. So if you want to come to that conference, you need to go to the Monocle website, which is monocle.com, and you can register your interest there for tickets. And you can see a full list of all the speakers. I think some 16 speakers already confirmed and many more big names on their way. But you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, and up next we're going to hear what propaganda was like on both sides of the English Channel in the age of Napoleon.
The weekly culture show on Monocle 24 is where you get your art kicks. Just recently we've welcomed Tracy Emin, Damien Hirst and Anish Kapoor to the show.
I look at it and I think, could I have really lived like that? Could it really been me? But I know that it was, so I do connect with it.
Culture is where you get your musical licks. Just the other day, Gregory Porter, Casey Musgraves and Diane Birch entertained our airwaves. They come round here, then go get their Grammys. Culture is your antidote to everyday arts coverage, featuring reports and interviews from everywhere you didn't know you wanted to get to know, in books, art, music, media, film, and everything from around the world beamed right between your ears. Culture premieres every Monday at 1900 London time, and why not visit monocle.com and iTunes for the archive of over 140 shows. Swing by and hear Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24.
The Globalist provides insight and analysis of the key news and business stories in Europe and the Middle East. Informed, engaging and authoritative, it's a 60-minute bulletin of news, features and opinion. Two presenters in London are joined by guests in our studio and all around the world, including Monocle's editors and friends in our Hong Kong and Tokyo bureau.
Monocle's Asia editor-at-large, Kenji Hall, joins us now from Tokyo. Can you explain a little bit about this turnaround in price?
The Globalist also features an extended daily newspaper review with a special guest here in Midori House.
They're claiming that these are going to be the most compact games of all time.
And of course, we round up the business headlines with an expert analyst in a key city. Plus, don't forget the Daily Monologue, an op-ed piece from one of Monocle's globe-trotting editors. From the sublime to the occasionally ever so slightly ridiculous, find out what the minds inside Midori House are thinking. All that and more every weekday at 6 a.m. London time on The Globalist.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. This year marks the 200th anniversary of the Battle of Waterloo. To commemorate this, the British Museum has opened a new exhibition on propaganda and satire in the era of Napoleon. The exhibition, Bonaparte and the British, Prince and Propaganda in the Age of Napoleon, shows works by both British and French satirists, and it focuses on how Napoleon was viewed in both countries between his rise as an army general in the 1790s and his death in St. Helena in 1821. Monocle's Marcus Hippie interviewed Sheila O'Connell, who's the curator of the exhibition.
What's really interesting, and we've tried to bring out in the exhibition, that especially in the early stages, we, the British, quite liked him, a lot of us anyway, because there was quite a lot of support for the French Revolution. We had been enemies of the French, of course, for 100 years, if not more, quite pleased to see the king losing the throne. But then, of course, we were terrified by the guillotining and the terror. But there was still a lot of support, and especially for this handsome young general who was so brilliant. I mean, at the age of 27, he drove the Austrians out of northern Italy and then went on to take over the Papal States in the most extraordinary way. So he was very much admired.
And then gradually changed.
Yes, and then things changed because then he became a threat to Britain. And especially when he was then sent off to Egypt, Egypt being the route to India, where France and England were already rivals for colonies. And we didn't like that at all, we Brits. Luckily, there was Admiral Nelson, who tracked down the fleet at the mouth of the Nile and blew it up. And that really was exciting back home when the news finally reached home. But Nelson was the hero of the sailors, and the sailors were the heroes of Britain because they kept the trade routes open and they were jolly people.
And during those events, you could see increasing amount of printed propaganda.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting what this exhibition is actually showing pieces of this propaganda. If we look at how Napoleon was depicted in Britain, what do you see in those pictures?
The first anti-Napoleon satires, they have no idea what he looks like. So they show him as a Corsican bandit with huge moustaches, and he's making the Pope kiss his bare backside. He's a sans-culotte, so he's not wearing any trousers. Then gradually, everybody gets to know what he actually looks like, because there are straight portraits, if you like. And those are being sold in England. People are fascinated by him.
Which features of Napoleon get emphasised when you look at those pictures?
The big thing that's emphasised, but not really until 1802, when we're really, really anxious about him, is that he's little bony. In fact, he was 5'6", was like 1.67 metres, which isn't particularly small even now. And at that time, it was a normal height. But because Britain was really frightened of him, the way you deal with that is to show your enemy as somebody tiny who you know that you can conquer. Although, of course, we also showed him as an evil murderer who would stop at nothing to get his way. But the thing that really stuck was little bony, and we still think of him. I mean, Freud talked about the Napoleon complex, small men with great ambitions, but it wasn't really true. And one thing I try to say to people when I'm talking about the exhibition is that we're not trying to tell the truth. We're trying to tell the story as it was told at the time.
And in a way, this is political satire, kind of propaganda at the same time.
Yeah.
If you were to choose one or two favourite pieces from the British side that can be seen in this exhibition, what would you choose?
My favourite one, and that's because I've been reading about Napoleon for 2 years or more, I have a lot more sympathy for him than I used to, is the one called The Plum Pudding in Danger, which is a very famous print. And it shows the globe as a plum pudding. And on one side of it is sitting Little Boney. On the other side is sitting William Pitt, the Prime Minister of England, who's always shown as incredibly thin. And they're carving up the world between them. So it's quite balanced. Napoleon's got hold of Europe, but what Pitt wants is basically the rest of the world. And he particularly wants the Atlantic trade, the Caribbean trade, which is incredibly lucrative.
Let's cross to the other side of the English Channel now. When we look at Napoleon, how Napoleon is shown in France, what do we see?
Well, Napoleon was, I think, the greatest propagandist of all time. His propaganda was really beautiful things. And I think I like to feel that this is partly Josephine's interest, because she was a woman of incredible taste. And she introduced him to a lot of designers who were producing that, ended up producing the wonderful Empire line. These fabulous buildings, fabulous furniture, fabulous clothes. One of the things that we're showing in the exhibition is a few of the series of medals that he had made. It was organised by a man called Dominique Vivant Denon, who was Napoleon's sort of museum director in the really big way. And Denon was charged with getting the best designers, the best die cutters, and the best technicians to make these wonderful medals. And we've got just a few in the exhibition, which show Napoleon's triumphs against the British. particularly one which shows Napoleon as Hercules fighting a merman, a sea creature, and it's called Frappé à Londres, struck in London in 1803, it says. But of course, he didn't get to London, so that became a great collector's piece, and there were lots of copies of it later on because people loved to make fun of what Napoleon didn't manage to do, although we kept rather more quiet about things like the Battle of Austerlitz, which he did so incredibly well at.
Sheila, you have curated this exhibition, Bonaparte and the British Prince and Propaganda in the Age of Napoleon. Do we learn something new? Do the people going to this exhibition, do they learn something new about Napoleon?
I think we very much hope so. What I hope that they will understand is that the idea that a lot of people in Britain really appreciated Napoleon, they were terrified of him, but there were a lot of people who thought he was, you know, there was a lot to be said for him. Our own government was not a very popular one. The king still had quite a lot of personal power. Of course, George III was very sick, and his son, the Prince Regent, took over from him in 1811. And he was someone who, I'm afraid there's not really very much to say for. He was someone who just wanted a life of pleasure, and he was spending the taxpayers' money like water. He would just buy whatever he wanted, and then he would go to Parliament and say, you know, you've got to pay. So that didn't go down very well with anybody. And I think that was part of the reason why we liked Napoleon, or some people liked Napoleon, was because comparing it with what we had on this side of the Channel.
Well, that was Sheila O'Connell, who's the curator of the British Museum's exhibition Bonaparte and the British, Prince and Propaganda in the Age of Napoleon. And she was speaking to Monocle's Marcus Hippie. The exhibition runs all the way through to August the 16th. Well, we're going to have some music now, and we're going to stick with that theme. What else could it be? This is ABBA with Waterloo. It's time now for our daily arts review. And joining us in the studio is the journalist and curator, Francesca Gavin. Francesca, thanks for coming in to see us as usual. Now, we're going to start in Stockholm at the Moderna Museet, which is having an exhibition of Louise Bourgeois.
And actually, it was really hard to choose which Louise Bourgeois show to talk about here, because there's also another incredible retrospective at the Haus der Kunst in Munich. But I picked the Stockholm one partly because there's a third of the works on show, and there's a huge amount of works on show have never been shown anywhere before. So it's a kind of once in a lifetime opportunity to see a whole breadth of work from an artist that I think is exceptionally fascinating for presenting a way that we're rewriting the canon of art. Louise Bourgeois was an artist she died a few years ago, but became more successful later and later within her career. And I think since her death, we're really seeing that with a huge number of female artists, people like Phyllida Barlow and Alice Neal, and like other artists who perhaps were less successful when they're younger, but are really becoming strong artists now and respected more. And I think Louise Bourgeois was one of the first people to do that, which I think is interesting.
Even the person who doesn't know much about art, if they've been to, you know, Tate Modern in its very early days when they had the spider there, and that spider pops up again when you go to kind of the Guggenheim Bilbao, a huge, huge kind of piece with the eggs in the belly of the mother spider. So we know there's some of the grand pieces. Do we know what else is going to be in this exhibition?
Well, I mean, her work is exceptionally broad. The earlier periods, she did some amazing sculptural works, often in bronze, often that look like eyes or balls or barnacles in some way. There's very sexual work. She also had an incredible approach to textiles, so lots of amazing sort of figurative work made out of sewn items. That's kind of one of her regular things. I mean, she's done everything, essentially. But if you want to go to Munich, what they're specializing in there in that show are her cells. One of the cells is in Stockholm, which are these sort of installations in round spaces filled with kind of dystopian, strange, unnerving, sexualized, psychoanalytic installations, which are very, very autobiographical. I mean, Maman, the giant spider, is very, very autobiographical about her very disturbed relationship with her own mother.
Well, the Moderna Museum is also a wonderful museum. We've done a couple of events there with the Monocle, and it's just one of those spaces that's very good for showing, especially sculpture, a kind of a really exciting place to see that. But something closer to home is at the Barbican Centre here in London, and it's called Magnificent Obsessions, and it's about what artists collect themselves.
Yeah, and it's fascinating. It's such a insight into different artists' work that you wouldn't necessarily have seen. So there's some people you'd expect to be there, like Peter Blake, who has an exceptional collection of ephemera that he incorporates often into the sculptures and even the paintings he's done throughout his career. And someone like Martin Parr, so it's got like a tiny little bit of his postcard photography selection. But then there's thousands of other artists that are so surprising. Like, so Sugimoto, best known as a photographer, collects the sort of a history of medical engravings and strange medical items. There's loads of stuffed animals that belong to Damien Hirst. Just a crazy weird selection of Mexican record covers owned by an artist called Dr. Lacra. Dan Vo, who's got a show also in London at Marion Goodman, had presented someone else's collection, this Chinese sort of outsider who collected everything from Disney mugs to cookie jars. There's also like Andy Warhol's own toy collection. And even though there's only a tiny amount of work on display for the different artists, it's so interesting and overwhelming.
And on the whole, do the collections kind of mirror or inform or have some connection with the art that those people then produce? Or do you ever look at the collection and think, oh my God, who would have thought that they liked or they collected?
I think in most cases you can see the connection. Sugimoto was a total surprise for me. I couldn't see that at all. Though there were some sort of fossils, which he's been photographing recently in more recent work. And for each artist, they usually include one or two pieces of their work so you can see the connection, which is interesting. But I mean, yeah, it's really fascinating also seeing how, like, let's say Pei White is a well-known American artist. She collects 1960s and 70s scarves by one specific illustrator and graphic designer. And it's very interesting seeing how that use of color and pattern gets incorporated into her tapestry works or her use of color within her own pieces. So you see things coming out in the artist's work, but in a very different way.
And then I guess with someone like Damien Hirst, obviously we know what he did with cows and sharks and all sorts of things. But I guess what's also fascinating is that as these artists become super successful themselves, they have the money to be quite important collectors and patrons. And I would imagine that Damien Hirst has got quite a few things put away now.
Actually, Hirst in particular is well known for being a collector. There was an exhibition of his work a few years ago at Serpentine because he does collect and buy a lot of young emerging art as well as established artists. And I think a lot of artists like buying other artists' work. It's part of the pleasure of success, you'd argue. But yet other people within it you felt were just kind of crazed collectors who couldn't stop getting stuff. There's a whole selection of weird things like being in a bad junk shop from Hannah Darboven, which is really disturbing and also fascinating, like weird things you don't want to look at but you can't tear yourself away from.
Okay, well, that sounds truly amazing. It's called Magnificent Obsessions. It's at the Barbican and it's on now and it's going to run all the way through to the 25th of May. And finally for today, we're going to be looking at Mingering Mike's Supersonic Greatest Hits, which is at the Smithsonian. What is this?
Mingering Mike is an amazing story. This kind of broke around the early 2000s. I remember writing about this as a baby journalist and some sort of record collector, strange hunter found a whole box of basically fantasy records, drawings, reviews that were made in the 60s and 70s by an outsider. Just it was obviously in a collection sale, like of his own character, if he had been a pop star, called Mingering Mike. And there was a book about it. It became a real cult hit in the early days of the internet. And then the Smithsonian amazingly bought this collection and it's now within it. There's over 150 pieces. So music and weird elements that sort of describe someone's sort of failed American dream that never really happened.
But do we know much about the artist? Or?
Well, the artist is alive, but it's not really engaged in making art. It's definitely not an art practice. It's definitely much closer to outside of folk art. And I think a lot of it was made when he was much younger. It's a bit someone's teenage fantasy almost, or in their younger years. But the artist is alive, apparently, and living in Washington.
But so his record covers all sorts of things.
Yeah, and they're amazingly drawn. They're drawn often with, like, coloured pens and colouring pencils, and they've got this kind of really often lined paper and this really DIY edge to it. And the amount of detail and attention to someone's fantasy is incredible. The idea of someone like having this idea of what they'd like to be, and very influenced by the music at that period in time. So Stevie Wonder and Marvin Gaye and that whole Motown period of culture. And if you imagine like what record covers look like then, imagine that done by a child with a crayon and by who's a bit older, and it's amazing. But also the audio is wild, which I think you can probably, a lot of it's archived. So it should be a really crazy exhibition and very something you would not expect to have.
So I didn't realize he recorded the songs as well.
He recorded the songs, he had the reviews, he wrote, he created an entire persona for himself essentially, which is really, really fascinating in a way. At a time where people had that idea that you could become anything, there was sort of, let's imagine like American Idol in its early baby days, before TV actually allowed the public onto it. So that amount of obsessive sort of devotion into the concept of you one day being famous. And the audio is hilarious as well. I mean, it's very kind of gritty.
So this is a show you can go and listen to and watch, I presume.
I'm hoping that they'll be including audio within it. But even alone, the visuals are fascinating.
And it's just great, the idea that this person, you know, almost used art in the same way that people use literature. He created a fiction. He created a tale and a story with kind of all of these many, many facets.
And also that it could have been completely forgotten, and the only reason why it exists is because someone discovered it in a yard sale and then kind of made it into a cult hit really naturally.
Yard sales of the future. Well, Francesca, thank you very much, as always, for coming to see us. That's Francesca Gavin, who, of course, is a well-known journalist and curator here in London. And that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Quentin Peel and Tim Marshall. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie. It was researched by David Pleasant and Stefano Fumagalli. And our studio manager was Sean Mullavy. Next, after the headlines, it's The Culture Show with Mr. Robert Bound. And then, at 2200 hours, it's The Monocle Daily. And today that's brought to you by Andrew Muller and Dominic Reynolds. The show, well, is going to be back at the same time tomorrow, which is 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, from me, Andrew Tuck, it's time to say goodbye and thank you very much for joining us.